I think we're at time. Are we at time? Is it time to go? We can get this show on the road. Great. Well, good evening, everybody. What an odd time to have a session. 5 o'clock. I can't imagine anyone's going to be hungry at all at this time. We'll get you through and onward to your beer and have a good time. How's Tech Ed been going so far today? Pretty good? Pretty good show? Yeah, I mean, there's stuff that I didn't even know about Windows, and I work real closely with the Windows team. So I'm really jazzed about pulling the keyboard cover off your Surface and have it go, hey, would you like me to switch into tablet mode? That's the thing that kind of jazzed. I'd never seen that before. So that's super cool. We actually, kind of preface to some of the things I'll be talking about on Thursday, we've got a couple of announcements still to come about Internet Explorer, which is where I spend quite a bit of my time, so that should be pretty exciting. But that's that. Let's talk about what we're here for today, which is security. And I wanted to preface it by really talking about exactly what we're going to be talking about. Because security is one of those really big loaded words that can mean many, many things. And I don't want you here thinking it's something that it's not. So we're not going to be talking about Forefront or any kind of packaged product. There is some content here this week that Chris Hallam is giving on the security that Windows is going to be providing, you know, from a platform perspective at a higher level. But this is not higher level stuff, as the console mode debugger might have tipped you off to. So what we are focused on today is really understanding the core security infrastructure of how Windows does an access check and what that means to applications. So whether you're an IT pro who cares about whether you can trust applications and how this changes the platform, or whether you're a developer who really wants to understand how they need to respond in their applications that you're creating, that's what we're covering. So if that's not what you want, there are probably other things that you may want to go see, although we're going to have some fun in here. So hopefully if it's not what you thought you wanted, we can persuade you to go, oh yeah, that actually is what I wanted. So fair deal, does that sound good? We're going to get gnarly, we're going to go under the covers, and we are going to have, my commitment to you, zero slides throughout the course of the entire talk. Some of you feel a little bit let down, but I think you'll be okay. Now, I'll say that, let me put a little caveat. It's actually a requirement of your employment at Microsoft that you run PowerPoint at every single session. Bet you didn't know that. This is the command line that I use to launch PowerPoint. So we'll go ahead and continue on, and now we have our PowerPoint. Which we can use to plan out our session. And what we're going to be talking about, oh, that didn't work out so well. I will say this, Zoomit seems to be struggling with Windows 10. So caveat also, all this stuff applies to Windows 10. In fact, a lot of it applied since Windows Vista, and we'll go and talk about where people may have been misunderstanding. We're going to talk about tokens and integrity levels. So if you're not familiar with those, that font is ridiculously small. So let me go ahead and bump that up to, I don't know, how about that? Tokens and integrity levels. We're going to talk about UIPI, or user interface privilege isolation, another Vista-era technology, but we're going to go deep and under the covers and make sure that you understand how it applies. We're going to talk about capabilities, and we're going to talk about app containers and their SIDs. So we're really going to do a full cross-section. And a lot of this, as I said, it's been around since 2006. But it's so broadly misunderstood. There's not a lot of tooling out there. There's not a lot of things that take advantage of it. And I was just having the conversation with my friend Mark Manassi out in the hallway where we said it's so surprising that not enough people are using this yet. And my guess is people still are struggling to understand it, and we'll give some examples of how that failure to understand might be causing some challenges. So first things first, we're going to take a look at some SIDs. I'm going to go ahead and launch a command prompt as admin in addition to my standard one. And we're going to bump up this font size because that's really small. Maybe we'll make it 36. That's pretty good. Who am I? /all/fo list. So a couple of the things that I always say from presentations, there are multiple dimensions on which to learn. Part of it's the content. But one of the things I go to see in presentations is, how do you present things better? So I like to give out some of the tips. So one of the tips I get a lot of questions about is, how come that one's red and the other one's blue? Because that's really convenient to tell the difference between them. And the reason is that coloring is remembered per shortcut. So I launched one with Window RCMD, and that shortcut gives me blue. And I launched the other one with right-click Command Prompt as admin. That different shortcut I configured as red. It also, talking about the shortcuts, gives me some way to waste time while I wait for all of these SIDs to resolve. Clearly not enough. So always have a plan B when it comes to presentations and be able to go and find things to look at directly in some other tool. And so rather than being dependent upon that, I'm just going to grab this command prompt here and look at the security tab here. Multiple different ways to find a challenge. So this one's running as medium, this one's running as high, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and dock these on both sides so we can start to look at what the difference is between them. So Windows, ever since the introduction of Windows Vista and the concept of UAC, has had this notion of multiple different levels of trust for the same person. And we're going to explore that all the way to its depths. But here's how you can see some of the differences between them. They're both me. And if I zoom in here in this incredibly small text, I can see, you know, 506219, 506219. Now probably one of you can start hacking me. Hopefully none of the hackers are here in the session, although it is a security talk, so I probably just gave away the crown jewels. But two different versions of me. This is fundamentally different from any other commercial operating system. If I'm on Unix, I have me and I have root, and they are different identities. These are two different flavors of the same me that we go through and modify. And if I look at all of my group memberships, which is clearly far too many, I obviously do much too much work, they're all the same. Where differences come in place is the administrator's membership, where one, it says deny, and the other, it says owner. The difference between them is the deny only flag means I can only use my membership in this group to deny me access to something. I cannot use it to grant access. So a real common question. I'm a member of the administrator's group. Why can't I go in here and muck around in program files? Well, mucking around is asking to be allowed to do something. And I can't allow you. I can only deny until I elevate. And the other significant difference comes into the privileges that are listed down below. With my full admin token on the right, my elevated token, if you will, I have a whole long list of privileges where my non-elevated token, I have 5. Now, the way I typically explain what standard users are and can do is like this, because it tends to apply really well. A standard user is able to muck around with all of their own things, but they cannot mess around with any other user on the computer or the state of the computer itself, which really can even be simplified to any other user, because that's what the state of the computer impacts. A privilege is permission to go beyond that. So the privileges that we grant you kind of make sense. Like, what would we want you to be able to do, right, as a standard user? Well, I'd like you to be able to shut down the computer, because if I don't give you permission to do that, what are you going to do with your laptop? You're just going to unplug it, because you have to go. That's why you own a laptop. So we give you that permission, even though clearly turning it off impacts other users. Same with undocking it, right? Same with changing your memory, and one big pain point is the ability to change your time zone. That was conflated for a long time with changing the time. Changing the time remains a privileged operation. Why? non-repudiability, that security principle. If I'm the bad guy, I change my system time to 8 hours from now when I know I'm going to be verifiably long way away from my computer, do the naughty thing, change the time back, and then go and make sure lots of people see me in this other place. And then when they look at the audit log, say it can't possibly have been me, I was over here, here's a security camera video of me. Now I can challenge your claim in the audit logs. That's why that's an admin level right. But changing the time zone does impact other users because there's one per computer. In fact, if you really want to mess around with somebody, switch to one of the half hour or 15 minute time zones because then you'll really mess up their calendar. But if you can't do that, you really can't travel. So that's why we grant all these privileges. That's the fundamental difference between the two. Now, for all of you security nerds who kind of get this, this is introductory stuff, but it's important that we all have the same understanding. So this won't be long. We're going to get onto it. We're going to go into some of the architectural principles into what happens when I go back and forth between them. So I have two windows. How did I get between them in terms of permissions? So I have winlogon, which is what I use to log on to the system. And when I log on as a member of the administrators group or any privileged group, it's going to go through and create my elevated token. And then it's going to create my filtered token, which looks very much like a standard user. And then it's going to call create process on explorer.exe with my filtered token. And the way that Windows permissions work and the way that those tokens work is you inherit your token from the process that made you. Therefore, explorer.exe is what you create most of your apps for, and it's going to have that filter token, and everything's going to look a lot like a standard user. Until such time as you want to elevate, at which point, then you have to call shell execute and either have the application request admin, and we'll talk about that, or use the run as verb if you choose to do it that way. That's going to call the app info service, which is going to call into consent.exe. And if that says yes, we'll create the process with your elevated token, with only one E in elevated. And then we're going to make it look as if the process that called shell execute is the parent process. So quick side note on some of the manifestations here and what you'll see. So back here, elevated token, filter token, we have two different instances, two different logon events. An architectural side effect of this is mapped network drives are in the context of a logon session, and you have two of them now. So if you map your network drives in the unelevated context, they won't show up in your elevated context, or vice versa, although typically it's the former that you actually see. That's always been true. That's not new. What's new is that you do this a lot more often than you used to. But you can go to a Windows XP machine, call runas.exe, launch with your own credentials, but create a separate logon session, and you won't have your map network drives there either. The difference is nobody sane does that on Windows XP, but people do it all the time on current versions of Windows. Another architectural side effect is if I'm passing information while elevating, we do go through and reparent. But I told you how the token gets inherited from your parent process. The other thing that gets inherited from your parent process is your environment block. And the environment block doesn't get recopied from the targeting process. It comes from the launching process, which in this case is the app info service. That's a process, and it's the parent process for this one. So therefore, if you're trying to pass information by setting environment variables, they don't get there. Doesn't happen too often, but that's the reason why that happens, is this architecture. The other thing that also confuses some people is shell execute itself. Why can't I use create process? And that's because of the refactoring of Windows itself. The way that we've been building Windows has been to try and organize it into layers. And the reason why we felt we needed to organize it is it was so complex. It had all of these circular dependencies back and forth between all of these different binaries. And if you remember a time when we had some of the Windows source code that someone had leaked out years and years ago, right? A lot of the lawyers were very angry about it. The Windows build team saw it as an opportunity. I don't care how you got it. I don't care who you got it from. If you can compile it, we'll hire you. That's how hard it was to build Windows. Right? So we had to say, listen, we're going to have a layer zero, and nothing outside of layer zero can depend on that. Layer one can depend on one or zero, but nothing else. Layer two can be on two or one or zero, but nothing else. And now it becomes organized. That allows us to compartmentalize and ensure that we have fewer circular dependencies. It was a huge architectural shift that's still going on. We're still refactoring. When you think about what elevation does, what does elevation do? Elevation will check group policy, so we have to have group policy support. Elevation will potentially show you a user interface with a window. So we've got to have a window manager. We've got to have dialog boxes. What can you do with create process that doesn't depend upon windows and window managers and services? You can do a lot. In fact, you can be a whole shipping SKU of ROS that doesn't even have a window manager in server core. So we can't take that dependency and create process. So architecturally, we just make sure that shell execute exists above all of those dependencies so that that's where you can do elevation. So that's the architectural reason why we have this thing that feels somewhat arbitrary. As we think through as well, all of the things that go around this whole elevation process, what I wanted to do was go into some of the policies that we have, which is how do we behave? Do we want to auto-elevate, ask the user, yes or no? These are all configurable. And I point this out because starting with Windows 8, if I go to the control panel, and just in case you were curious, if you think we didn't notice that people don't like prompts, if you search for the word prompt, guess what the very first return result is? Change user account control settings. And if you bring it all the way to the bottom, starting at Windows 8, it does not turn it off. UAC is still on when I do that. And what we've set that to is elevate without prompting. Something asks for elevation, it just gets it. But UAC is still turned on. So UAC started off as this kind of unloved redheaded stepchild of Windows Vista that made everybody hate it, right? Although historically, one of my very good friends who's not here with us this week, Aaron Margosis, who's one of our big security guys within Microsoft, he wrote a tool called Make Me Admin, which evolved into UAC. So you can sort of point the finger at him as being the father of UAC, if you will. That all came from him, and UAC is now fundamental to everything that we do, and we'll talk about how it's been baked into the OS, to the point where starting with Windows 8, continuing in 8.1, continuing in 10, we do zero testing with UAC disabled. We have no idea what happens. We've never looked at it. How many of you disable UAC today? Yeah, so one. So this guy who's like, oh, wow, am I really the only one? Yeah, you are the only one, pal. What's your name and company? It's okay.
We'll be publishing that on the web later on, everybody.
And it's become really fundamental. So the things that irritated people, we've heard the feedback and we've tried to address it. And these are all configurable. To figure that out. When I look at the group policies around UAC, The thing that is important, number one, keep it on. You have an off switch, and in typical group policy fashion, how many of you do group policy for a living? So maybe a third of you guys. So you guys must really love double negatives, because we do. That's not even triple. I think that you cannot be a straightforward text writer and write the group policy descriptions. What we do to turn UAC on or off is we call it run all administrators in admin approval mode. This applies actually to everybody. So it's completely misleading. That's your master kill switch. Don't throw it, because it will probably hurt you. There are all kinds of really strange things that happen. And there's so many things we can do with applications to fix them, and I've got lots of app compat talks in the past that can help you get through that. That's your on or off switch. To me, the important thing is, how am I going to get my help desk to help my end users? And the reason why is that, we talk about what you can do in terms of help desk. My admins, I'm okay, but my standard users, those are the ones I need to help from the help desk. If I prompt for credentials, what do users do when they see a credential prompt pop up? They call your help desk. And they say, I need the credentials. Because the dialog box tells them to. Call your admin. Have them come by. This is really designed for the consumer scenario. This is one of my kids raising their hand. Dad, come type your password. All right, what is it? Oh, no. You figure that out, right? Most people don't just have help desk people walking the aisles at work waiting for a hand to go up. Right? Now, you can. It makes it very easy for the help desk if they can type it in. Right? If you can generate support the additional help desk volume that it tends to create. The other one says automatically deny, and it pops up a dialog box saying this application is denied by policy. It sounds pretty scary. It doesn't actually tell you why, which tends to dramatically minimize help desk requests. But it also makes it harder for the help desk to get in and elevate. So you've got to figure it out, number one. Number two, we have this secure desktop concept. And if you're on the secure desktop, other than MSRA.exe, most remote software does not remote out the secure desktop, which means the help desk can't see it. Only the person in front of the computer can see it, which means the only person who can type the credentials is the person who doesn't have them, which is not so helpful. So if you want them to type it from the remote desktop, then ensure that you turn off the secure desktop so they can type it. It's a defense in depth measure designed, since the boundary of window messages is the desktop, to make sure that I can't use UI automation techniques. But you also have, since it's defense in depth, integrity levels and UIPI protecting you, which we're going to go into. So those policies are pretty important. I'll point out, as long as we're in there looking at them, that we have a policy that says allow UI access applications to prompt for elevation without using the secure desktop. And you would normally think, aha, that's handy. That's exactly what I want, with one small problem. That doesn't apply to all UI access applications. It applies only to MSRA.exe, which is using an internal-only undocumented API to do that work. So again, our group policy text writers win again. So that's what that comes down to. So that's kind of some of the configuration of how that works. The next thing is, all right, so we talk about elevation. We get an understanding of how it works. And I've got a question, though, which is, how do I elevate? I mentioned that before. Maybe the application asks for it. How does it do that? So if I'm an application, I can put that into my manifest. And Visual Studio actually does a nice job of building that into the tools for C++ code. For any managed code, it makes it really, really easy for you to automatically say, don't prompt for admin, and gives you no option to prompt for admin. And oh, by the way, we automatically insert that as soon as you upgrade your project. So just so you are aware that that happens. But the developer can ask for it by putting it in their XML manifest. So the developer knows. If it's prompting, though, there's this misperception of, oh, we've detected it needs permissions, which is not true. We can't reverse engineer all the things the code's going to do in any reasonable amount of time. So we've got to predict it. How do we predict it? Well, we look for the one scenario that we know requires admin rights, right? And this dates all the way back to beta 2 of Windows Vista, was when we came up with this. Because we test every single day a collection of applications. And in the Vista timeframe, it was about 1,000. Win 7 was about 3,000. Win 8, it was about 5,000. Win 10, I actually don't have the current count, but it's probably 6, 7, 8,000 now. Every single day, we test them to see what worked on the last one and still works now. So we understand the impact of compat. The beta 1 builds, our numbers were fluctuating, but they are in the high 90 percentile. The beta 2 build was the first one after we branched where we turned on UAC by default. And our numbers went from in the high 90s to 20. And we thought, wow, so 4 out of 5 pieces of software not working is probably not going to sell a lot of operating systems. I'm guessing. It was bad enough with, you know, 3 out of 10, which is what we actually finished up with. Although it's better today. Now it's about 8 out of 10. 2 out of 10. 8 out of 10 work. And the problem was nothing installed. Because no existing installers were asking for elevation. And there's a lot of software that's not an MSI. MSIs, we know you're a setup because you're an MSI. In fact, to make an MSI not prompt for elevation, it's really very simple and obvious. You change bit 3 in the word count summary field in the summary information stream to be 0. Obvious, right? So that's how you handle that one. But non-MSIs, we didn't find any of them. So we have to look for them. And so here's the logic. And you can find it all using a tool that I'm using directly from the App Compat toolkit called Compatibility Administrator. We try to check if you're a setup. And it's really, really complicated logic. We look for if it has the word setup somewhere in the file name or somewhere in the properties. In case you have either half-width or full-width katakana, that's seto apu, which is the Japanese way of saying setup. And that's it. Are you named setup? In which case, I'll think you're an installer. So there's setup. There's update. Whoops. Update, which looks for the text. Update. And then let me. There's installer detection. INSTAL, wildcard, or patch. And those are the things we look for. And this is just in the name of it. We exclude addpatch.exe, dispatch.exe, dispatcher.exe, wi-dispatcher.exe. We include everything else. That's it. That's all the more complicated it is. This was a last-minute escalation for a big electronics retailer in the U.S. where they had a content updater that was called contentupdater.exe, which was prompting for elevation on every single one of their demo PCs on the floor, which clearly they weren't going to sustain. And that was because of the installer detection. In fact, another one of my customers I worked with, they live a couple towns south of me. It's a company called Flexera Software. Anyone ever heard of them? So they have a division called Install Shield. Guess what every single one of their applications includes? INSTAL as a string is in all of them. Everything prompted. So they had to turn the feature off. But that's what installer detection does. It's really simple, very straightforward. There's not a lot of rocket science to the heuristics. But that's why we prompt. So there's 3 reasons. The developer asked for it via XML in the manifest. The IT administrator asked for it by putting one of these flags in a custom shim database, or we think it's a setup. And that's the logic we use. Right, so that's why things prompt. There's no sense of because it has to. We have no idea why it has to. Okay? So now we've got 2 different levels. The one thing we didn't look at closely. Wrong command window. Let's get this one. Is something that's, I believe, towards the top. If not, we'll go to the bottom. Let me just drag this. I think it's at the bottom. I guessed wrong. That's right here at the very bottom. Mandatory integrity levels. So this is the final concept, and it's an important one, and it's one that's really underutilized. It's the idea of trust-based authorization in Windows. So the historical authorization was based upon identity. Who are you? I am Chris Jackson, a member of all of these groups. And I either am allowed access because I or one of my group memberships is granted access, or I'm not. And that's it. There's no way for me to differentiate between levels of trust. Now, think about what that might mean. If you work in the payroll department, that means you have the application that writes everybody's paychecks running with the exact same level of trust as your web browser. That's out surfing good knows what. If it's a woman, probably fairly safe thing. If it's a man after hours, probably some less safe things. And if you think what that meant on Windows XP, how many people ran Windows XP as non-administrators? Right? A couple of people. You probably had a tough time with AppCompat, I'm guessing, because it was really hard. There wasn't a lot to help you. People who made that leap were either very patient or it took a long time. I'm guessing for those who said yes, that was not a like 6-month project. He's like, no, not at all, right? That was really hard. So they run it as admin most of the time. That means the entire internet is an administrator on your computer, right? Assuming that there's maybe some software vulnerabilities on there. Now, I'm guessing, right, that 100% of you have never once, even for a couple of days, run a version of, say, Java that's not the absolute most current, right? No one's ever done that. Because there's no known published vulnerabilities there at all. That's the challenge, right? So how do we incorporate this level of trust? And we incorporate through this concept of integrity levels. Now, how integrity levels work is that every single process, as part of its token, has an integrity level. This one is medium. And when I go to my red elevated one and scroll up past this huge list of terrifying privileges, you see it's running as high. Medium and high. And the concept itself, you know, if I look at it, you can see that this has a SID. And the internal representation in the kernel itself, because it's part of the kernel mode process object, that internal representation is a 32-bit number. So technically, there are over 4 billion different possibilities. So far, we've used about 4. So we've got some room to grow. And this is all about determining how well things are trusted in comparison to each other. Every process has it. Every securable object, and securable objects, I mean specifically an object that has a representation in kernel mode, because that's where the comparison takes place, such as a file, which is a kernel mode object, a registry key, a synchronization object, like an event or a mutex, all of those can have an integrity label and an integrity policy. The label says what level am I allowed to use, and the integrity policy says what can I do with this policy. And to explain that, right, rather than, you know, artificial slideware of like writing things on the screen, which is kind of cheap, don't you think? Let me clean up my screen here. A beautiful PowerPoint. What I'm going to do is I'm going to get my command window open. We'll take this one and clear the screen, and we're going to use the PS exec utility, which is a sysinternals tool. For those of you who are not familiar, sysinternals you should use all the time, just in terms of the breadth of what you can do with these. And here I launch PS exec with the dash L switch, which means I'm going to launch it with low integrity. And if I look here with Process Explorer, also a sysinternals utility, I've added to it this column for integrity, and I've launched this one with low. So I don't trust this very much. I have a low level of trust. And what we do is we just compare the level of trust you have with the label on the object. If it's lower, then we compare the policies. The policies can include no read-up, no write-up, no execute-up. And if I have it as no read-up, I won't be able to read from low to medium or high. No execute-up, I won't be able to launch it from something that's less trusted. It's linearly just directly upwards. It's not, up can crawl down all it wants to. It's not isolation within a tier, but it's isolation from going above where you are. Low can't go above low. Medium can go to low or medium. High can go low, medium, high, but not system, which is the fourth one. Typical processes that run system are your system services. High are your elevated applications. Medium, standard user applications, and low are untrusted applications. So you've got this hierarchy, and the default, if you don't do anything, is medium with no write-up. Not no read-up, but no write-up. That's the reason why we call it mandatory integrity control instead of mandatory privacy control, because it doesn't protect your privacy. So if we go ahead and try to save something, save as, and I'll try to drop this in my documents, and I'll do test.txt, and this is why you also learn that you can never trust an error dialog. Hey, I can't write it there. How about my documents? Which is where I'm trying to write. So I can get caught in an infinite loop. Yes, that's a good idea. Oh, I still can't do it. Well, I'll take your advice again. And I can't write there. Because no one ever expected you'd launch Notepad with low integrity. It wasn't something that we saw in our test plan. So what I can do to kind of circle past that, I want to showcase how we could eventually write there. So I'll go into my folder, I'll go into documents, and I'll make a new text file. And I'll call it test.txt. My explorer.exe is running as medium, it's running as me. And then, so it's test.txt, I'm going to use a utility from my friend Mark Manassi, who's also here presenting, giving a few sessions today. I'm using his tool, and we're actually, he's talking to him today. He's working on a PowerShell script to do the same. I'll do test.txt, and I'm going to set the integrity level to low. And it's going to give me an error, too, because that file is not there, because I'm not in my documents directory. That's awesome. Okay, so I called it text.txt. That's awesome. I am great at spelling. There we go. So this tool just writes some code to change the integrity level as well as the policy. So it's going to say, you know, no read-up, no execute-up. It's low, though, so it kind of doesn't matter what the policy is. Once I've done that, then I'm able to go ahead and open this file. Type into it, and save it, because it's low. And then if I were to change it back, and say, don't allow me to read up, now I'll try to open the file I just wrote myself with the exact same process, and I'll get access denied. Same me. Same file, but the integrity level change on there gets labeled differently. And the reason why I think that's so spectacularly interesting is think about some of the things you'd like to change permission for reading on. If you do any files that you think untrusted things shouldn't be able to read. Because I make some, right? I use Quicken to do my finances. I go in and deliberately, using the Chumble tool, label my file as no read-up and no write-up because there's no reason my web browser should even go in poking around in there. I don't care that it's encrypted. It's additional defense in depth. And there are all kinds of scenarios where that might be interesting. We didn't do it by default for app compat reasons. Nothing to do with security. It's going to break all kinds of things. And so, therefore, we didn't do that as the default. So the next layer of that, sitting on top of that whole concept, is the notion of user interface privilege isolation. And for those who haven't, you know, either who aren't developers or who haven't written Petzold-style code in a really long time, there's one really important aspect of the Windows architecture that you need to understand, which is how Windows communicates. Windows communicates, in essence, every single Windows program ever written can be thought of as a loop. We listen for messages, and we send a lot of them. These are all the messages coming to my calculator window. We just listen for them, and then we act. Oh, the mouse moved! Do you care? And if it does, then it can do something crazy. And if it doesn't, then it can ignore it. It's nothing but a loop. Pick up the messages, process them, and then wait for the next message to come in. That's how all of Windows works. And window messages do not have security descriptors. There is no security check. So you just ask the window message, hey, can you give me the window named this? All right, let's call it start. And then the window manager will return it. And then you send a message to it. And the application cannot tell the difference between a window message that came from a physical mouse and a window message that came from an app pretending to be a physical mouse. There is no way to tell the difference and no security descriptor. If you're on the same desktop, right? So if I really wanted to get someplace private, I can make a new desktop now, right? Or I could use sysinternals desktops on older versions of the operating system. If I'm on the same desktop, I can send window messages to anything else on the same desktop, anything. And there's no way for me to tell the difference. So how do we protect that? We protect that through user interface privilege isolation, which very simply says window messages cannot be sent up. We compare the process ILs. Low can't send to medium. Medium can't send to high. There's a white list of some messages that will get through. It's very short. You can add more if you want to listen, but you don't have to. So if I look at, you know, one of the designs, oh, I got two of them now. That's awesome. Designs that we saw for a lot of misbehaving applications. Here's an application that's doing something elevated, but this window is owned by a medium integrity process. As a result, anything else at medium integrity can use UI automation to drive it. No hands on the keyboard. It just entered the credentials for me, and now it's made a new user. What user interface privilege isolation does is it allows us to say, oh, let's go ahead and create that window from the elevated process. So if I use the window finder, say, find me that window here, I can see that this is, oh, let's scroll out of sight, this guy, newuser.exe, running at high integrity. No. High integrity. And as a result, the attacker is not able to use UI automation because of the integrity level change. If I ran the attacker as admin, then he'd be able to do it. But hey, he's already admin. He doesn't need you to do that. But just to prove that it actually works, we'll go ahead and run it. And now it can crack the dialogue because now I'm elevated. Now I'm not. I don't have UIPI blocking me. Incidentally, for those of you who are kind of command line junkies, but not super command line junkies, you could do things like this before. Drag and drop uses window messages. So guess what breaks? I can't drag and drop here. Nothing ever gets there. Whoops. And that's because the window messages are blocked from my medium integrity explorer to my high integrity command line window. That's why that works. So that's the foundation that we came through for Windows 7. So all of that stuff, if you're on Windows 7 today, you have that as part of your core baseline for what the application platform can do. Right, so the next question is, what does Windows 8 do on top of that? So to do that, we'll be looking at some C++ code, of course. It did say 400, right? We had a command line debugger when you walked in. You don't have to understand code. I'll walk you through it. But what I wanted to show you was how all of this comes together and what we add on top of that. So if we look here at what we're trying to do, I'm just going to go ahead and launch this application. Let me make sure it's designed the way I intend it to be designed. Let's undo that guy. Clearly, I was doing one too many run-throughs. And let's go ahead and launch it on the local machine, which will require me to rebuild it. And what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be calling one of the new Windows Runtime, or Windows RT, APIs. And that is, incidentally, why we called... don't load symbols, just load the app. Or make me wait. That'll be super awesome if we just kind of sit here looking at a logo for a really long time. And I'm very impatient, so I'm going to try starting this without debugging. Wow, this is fantastic. Just go ahead and hang on me. I believe I told you not to load symbols. So what do we do when something misbehaves? Oh, really? All right, well, we'll go ahead and clean up while we're waiting. You still making me wait? Yeah, well, you know what we do to naughty processes that don't listen. Details, devinf.exe. Yes. Hopefully we corrupted memory state. That would be great. So here we go. We've built it and deployed it. Preparing solution. Da-da-da. Now let us debug, start without debugging. I'm not really interested in getting it onto a debugger. And I'm going to go ahead and hit this. And it's going to just immediately throw an error. And the reason why, if I actually had the debugger attached, is it would tell me that it needs a capability to do that. Because here's what I'm trying to do. In the API I'm trying to launch, this is called the WinRT button, or Windows Runtime button, we're trying to get the documents library and create the file in that library. And it's going to say, well, you don't have the capability to do that. Capabilities are the ability to add an additional SID into that token, called a capability SID, and when I click it, it'll be allowed to create it. And if I look at the token of it, I'll actually see that capability. So I'm going to look for fileaccess.exe, and if I look at the security token, I'll actually see this capability in clearly readable English. Right? If you speak SID, right, that's really easy to see. But I can see it right here. Your documents library, I have the capability. And how that works is because the capability is what's presented. Because what I'm going to next do is I'm going to look at what process monitor does in terms of how that gets written. So process monitor, the secret to using procmon, I've always found, is to collect for the minimum amount of time possible so that you minimize the amount of noise. So we'll go ahead and clear it off, empty it out, and I'm going to quickly start collecting, execute, and then stop collecting. And then I'm going to search. I'm going to filter and show me where the path contains, and the name of the file is sample.dat. And here's something interesting. File access doesn't write it. This thing called the runtime broker.exe writes it. This is a medium integrity process. Aha, that's interesting, because now I have my documents library, which technically I shouldn't be able to write to. This is a low integrity process. Right, it's called app container, but if I look at it and look for the integrity, it's low. Low can't write there, because the default is medium no write-up. Remember, Notepad couldn't write there, so how do I write there? I get a broker to do it for me. Incidentally, that's exactly what Internet Explorer does. Internet Explorer runs it low. You want to save a picture? It can't save it there. So it calls its broker to do that for it. So it calls the broker, and the broker inspects it to say, do you have the capability that would allow you to do that, yes or no? And if you do, then it goes ahead and writes there. Now, we recommend that you don't use the documents library capability because that allows you to write whatever you want to and just own the documents library, which kind of breaks you out of the whole concept of being untrusted in the first place. So we say that's not a good idea. So let's take that capability off. And we'll look for other ways that we could write it. So the next bit of code, right, fairly straightforward, we're going to do what all us AppCompat guys love to do, which is hard code a path. Because that never goes wrong. And we'll drop it directly into my documents, because no other user would ever run this application. So that'll be great. So let's go ahead and rebuild that one with that capability modified. And we'll go ahead and start that without debugging. And it's going to try to write it directly into sample2.dat. And I'm going to click it, and it's going to say, oh, you can't, error 5. Error 5, incidentally, 5 is almost always access denied. 8000000005, access denied. That 5 number is a big trigger. 5 is bad. Can't get there. So I'm not allowed to write it. So then I think, aha, I remember from that security talk about how it's running at low integrity, and it's trying to write it directly. And I could even see that if I were to start running this. I'm going to add to the filter the path contains sample2.dat. And let's go ahead and clear it off and start it running. And then when I try to write it, I can see the access denied coming directly from that process. So now I'm trying to save it as me, and I'm running into that wall of integrity. I'm like, all right, let me work my way around that one. How do I do that? Oh, I remember what that guy did. That guy just went in, and he just did a chmul command. So let's, first of all, let's make the file, because create file, if it already exists, will just open the existing one. So let's find our sample.dat. And we'll just control C, control V, and we'll give it the name of sample2.dat. 2, there we go. And now that it's renamed, I can just use a documents chmul sample2.dat and mark it as low integrity, and that'll get us going. So now let's go back and try it. And I still have error 5, right? That's supposed to happen, because there's more to it. Because here's the problem. When we first started introducing the concept of the untrusted app, low integrity, there was one application in the whole world that used it. I explored Xe, the browser. Since that time, Office, starting in Office 2010, if you open a document with Mark of the Web, we'll put it into protected view. Same thing, low integrity. Adobe Acrobat, starting at version 11, opens the documents in low integrity. Google Chrome opens, they actually use integrity level of 0, which is untrusted because low wasn't quite low enough for them. But same idea, right? So there are 4 mainstream applications, but still not a ton. And so we said, okay, well, we're about to make this the default for every single Windows runtime application that's ever made. And as soon as we do that, it's like, well, if everything is in the cesspool, we're not protecting you very well. So how do we make it so that you trust these things, but they also can't then go knock each other out to create a trusted application ecosystem? The problem we're trying to solve is helping you trust apps again. Because we estimate that at least 12% of all applications that will run on Windows 32, right, the Windows app platform, at least 12% of what you find on the internet, and probably a lot more, is or contains malware. So you'd be foolish to trust it blindly. How do we make a platform that you can start to trust again, knowing how many bad guys there are? And that is, well, don't just let you muck around with every other Windows 8 app, because that wouldn't be cool, because then you wouldn't trust Windows 8 apps anymore either. They wouldn't hurt your desktop apps, but they go attacking each other. Not cool. Put up partitions between them. That partition concept is what we call the app container. So what the app container does, and you may have noticed this when we looked at it in Process Explorer. Let's go and take a look at it again. We'll take a look, and here's file access. It has this app container SID sitting inside of it. Every modern application, every Windows Store, I wish we had the word Metro still, because I don't even know what to call them anymore, but every Windows runtime application has an identity. That identity is expressed as a SID. They're all different. So starting in Windows Vista, every service had an identity with a service SID. Starting in Windows 8, every Windows runtime application, not your desktop apps, but your immersive or whatever we call them now, WinRT apps, has an identity. And when we see that you belong to an app container, we not only isolate you as low integrity, we isolate you from other things and start to box you in. So if I wanted to be able to write here, here's what I would have to do. I would have to go and grab this SID, right? And that's S dash. I didn't get in there. So let me go ahead and, whoops, not Sonos. I do like Sonos, but I don't know how to stop it. I'm going to use iCackles, sample 2, and I'm going to grant and S dash, whoops. Oh, Control V is not in there yet. I was so excited about that today. I'm like, I'm totally doing that in my demo. And no. Right click, paste. And I'm going to grant full control to that app container identity. So with the combination of allowing low and allowing that app container as an identity, I will finally be able to directly create and modify that file. So I not only isolate you into the cesspool of untrusted apps, I now have partitions between them. That is what an app container is. There's also a concept of all app containers. If I wanted to trust everything in an app container to be able to reach into me, I can also do that. Right, so I can add the all app container SID, or I can just add, you know, the one app container if I want to. Now, we talked about this incredibly convoluted process for writing things, right? Whether I have to go through the Windows Runtime API and grant myself a capability that is already mentioned as being somewhat dangerous, or going with the Windows 32 API directly and having to do this incredibly convoluted reverse my SID and put permissions on there. How in the world am I going to write a file? And the answer is, just ask the user where he wants to put it. And if the user can pick wherever they want to, and because they chose, then I'll be able to write there. And if I go in and look at what we saw in Process Monitor, we'll go ahead and add to the filter, path contains sample 3.dat. And are we collecting now? I think we are. If not, we'll know in a second. And here we go. I'm coming through the picker host. Because the user got to pick, it's okay. Because it's going to say, you know what? You need to be able to write files. And if the user knows, it's okay. Right? What you can't do is you can't go writing stuff wherever you want to. But if the user says, oh, no, this is okay, I want to put that there, then that's okay. And that's going to be protected by UIPI. That's a medium integrity process. Right? So this is the foundation upon which we're building. How do we build some trusted applications? And it applies beyond even how we start to give permissions to the applications. It also applies to any synchronization events that we build. So if I go in and look at the process here, in fileaccess.exe, the bottom pane view I've set to show me all of the handles that I have. And I asked to have an event created called my event. And what you used to be able to do was something called namespace squatting. If you created something in your session namespace and you're the first one to get there, subsequent people would come along and they could open it. right? Because you'd be create object, and if one already exists, it'll just hand you a handle to the existing one. So if you're the bad guy, get there first, open the object, and wait and listen for things to come through. What this has done is it's prefixed the SID for that particular app container into the name of the event. So now it is private just to that app and no longer shared amongst everything in the same logon session. So we've isolated it there as well. So now you start to build this whole end-to-end story about how you're able to go through and isolate all of those applications. Now, one thing to comment about on this concept of the app container is the app container SID is a hash generated by the name of the vendor and the name of the application. So when you look at, you know, what are the rules that we have for what goes into the Windows Store, those have to be unique. Otherwise, they're going to generate the same hash, which is the identity of the application. So we enforce that. If you're doing sideloading, you're responsible for doing the same thing. So just so you know what you're on the hook for, sideloading says, I'm going to make sure that I don't have a bunch of things with the same name generating the same identity. When I'm going through and signing them, that's going to be part of my process. And that's where the identity of the application comes in. So a couple of sort of ancillary commentary on this. When we look at a feature we put into the browser, I know it's beer time. Can you tell? Everyone's like, there's beer down the hall, and I'm in a room with no beer. It's okay. Listen, I'm all about the beer, so you are 100% forgiven. Bring one back. Anyone want to take any bets on whether that actually happens or not? I'm guessing at about a 0% chance he's gonna give us some love and bring us some beer. One of the concepts that comes up, and you see it in the security pane, is this concept of enhanced protected mode. So enhanced protected mode treats IE, even desktop IE, as belonging to an app container. It's the only desktop app that I know of, though God knows someone's figured out some way to do it, but that I've ever seen in real life, that is able to run as part of an app container. And in doing it, you significantly restrict any damage that can be done, because we're already running it at low integrity. If I look at what we're doing with internetexplorer.exe, which is the most common untrusted process that people run, here's what the architecture looks like. There we go. I have a parent process and a child process. The parent process is running at medium, and the child process is running at low. The parent is the broker. It hosts the frame. It hosts the Chrome, the address bar, the back button, the forward button. It's 64-bit, and the child is always 32-bit. That's different, by the way. If you're running Windows 7 with IE8, first of all, IE8's terrible. Get a new browser. We'll talk about that later. That's Thursday. Because it used to be 2, right? That was really crazy. People launched a 64-bit browser and nothing would work. 64-bit process containing a 32-bit process, enhanced protected mode, can run the tab process as a 64-bit process. That's an option. But the big thing is putting it into an app container, which means not only are you in low, you're in the cesspool, now you're in the cesspool with walls, just like Windows 8 apps. So that if something is able to compromise an application, then they're contained by the same app container rules that impact other Windows 8 applications. Makes it significantly more secure. Also tends to be ridiculously incompatible with existing ActiveX controls. We shipped it on by default when Windows 8 first came out, and about a month and a half later, we turned it back off again. We said, okay, yeah, this is pretty terrible. I'm going to speculate maybe it had to do with a certain web framework,
Silverlight,
that was on a lot of Microsoft properties, would show an S, hey, something on here is not compatible with enhanced protected mode, so maybe this web page sucks. Over and over again, right? That would continue to come up. In the enterprise, that was also very prevalent, which is things wouldn't work. There's a lot of ActiveX in the enterprise, most of it written in VB6. And so that becomes a problem. So we now turn it off by default. Now, when we talk about security and what the ramifications are, the old days of all or nothing, right, which is no admins anywhere at all, period, everyone must have enhanced protected mode, I don't think makes sense anymore. There's a great security statement that I think really completely resonated with me and hopefully does with you, which is, if you protect your diamonds with the same veracity that you use to protect your paper clips, you'll end up with a lot more paper clips and a lot fewer diamonds. And the same thing applies here, right? If I go after everyone has to have enhanced protected mode and everything breaks and business be darned, it's secure, it doesn't make a lot of sense, right? It's really secure to throw your laptop into a pit and cover it with cement too, but it's not really productive. Instead, let's figure out, where are my high-risk people? And if I have someone who's using some very high-risk stuff, right, if they use a web browser at all, then maybe it makes sense to put that into enhanced protected mode. Going after everybody's really hard. I mean, it'd be interesting to know, but what I'm guessing is most of you have a pretty large dependency on ActiveX, because most organizations do, right? We're trying to get out of it. The browser can do so much more that more and more you don't need it once you have a chance to rewrite all of your stuff. But the average age of the enterprise application is about 12 years. So I'm guessing you're not going to be done rewriting all of your stuff by Tuesday. So do it as it makes sense and figure out where enhanced protected mode can make sense, because we can put in some additional protection there as well from this design. Oh, and in case you're curious, I can show you the untrusted SID. Let me get it launched here. Oh, my machine's slowing down. There we go. And here is untrusted. And the SID on this guy, S116.0. Plain old flat out zero. 32-bit number, you can manipulate this all you want, put in whatever random numbers you want to. I've seen people fiddle around with that. I haven't seen a business case for it, but it's possible, right? It's a 32-bit number. You can pick any value you want for it. But that is extensible and something that you can control. The other thing, to finally kind of close out, we're guarding you from communicating through files, through events, through registry. We're isolating you. So that I think a very reasonable question is, what if I want to talk to something? Because here's a really common dev scenario, right? People who will sell you software development services would be happy to rewrite all of your stuff top to bottom, wouldn't they? Because you're paying them for it. Do you want to have to rewrite everything just to make a modern experience? One of the examples, and we didn't show you what was behind the curtain, what's there, but an example that we gave during the launch of Windows 8 was for Emirates Airlines, where we had, here's this great tablet-based experience. Modern UI, it looked great, and that was super important, right? They didn't want anything that looked VB6-y at all on these screens. And it's getting more and more important when you start talking about Surface Pro 3s, which I'm seeing a lot of people embracing them in the organization. Those screens are crazy high resolution. Throw a VB6 form, and it's like tiny and really hard to use with your fingers. Build a new experience on top of it. The Emirates Airlines example and many, many others just runs the desktop apps in the background and calls back into them. And what they do is they do what's called loopback. So if you're a developer, you can do a web service call that calls to localhost, and that's okay in the dev scenario and used to be not okay in production. You get rejected from the store. And we still will reject you from the store, but we now officially, as of Windows 8.1 Update 1, say you can do it on your sideloaded apps and with our blessing. Because that's how you communicate back to your desktop apps. You're isolated. You can't talk to them. You can't write to the file system, right, unless you change a whole bunch of permissions, which is really hard, really complicated, and really easy to get wrong. Do a web service call with a loopback, and now you can go back and talk and then you only have to build new front ends and leverage as much of your existing code as you think you possibly can while you gradually evolve these things step by step. You don't have to wait till everything's done. You can get a modern UI and loop back, and it works despite all of these protections. So to kind of sum things back up, I mean, we really kind of groveled back through tokens all the way back, you know, XP into Vista, into Win 7, into Win 8. The net result is we're really trying to build a platform on which you can finally trust code again. Because if the code goes bad, the only thing it can do is commit suicide. It can't commit mass murder of your apps. What a grisly American analogy to use. I think it's something better than that. We're way too violent in America. But the only thing it can do is hurt itself. It can't hurt everything else, right? And that's part of the design. Now, technology is not the only thing we have to protect against. Technology plus human intervention. That's why we in the store look over all these things. And we not everything was necessarily useful, but at least we verify that it's not going to go out hunting and destroying other apps in systematic ways. So we validate that. We validate some of the security concepts there. And the same responsibility falls when you talk about sideloading. You have to sign it with your digital signature, or it doesn't go down. And we do the same thing. So with technology, capped with that human element, we can start to build that trusted application ecosystem again, and once again, you can run code. So if you're one of those organizations that thinks, I'll get Windows 8 and I'm turning off the store for everybody, now you can think, maybe I can turn off the store for my road warriors who might want to throw Netflix on there, because I can trust Netflix to not come in and whack anything else, and now my execs can watch their Top Gear from their hotel room. Thank you very much. If you want me to violate my promise of no PowerPoints. But that's the only way I can do it. So if you're good with just looking up me, we can do zero PowerPoints. So you just let me know if you want to keep